I next met with Dr. Karim Fizazi, and to begin, he discussed the patient from his practice. So let's talk about this man. He's in his early 70s. When did you first start working with him?
So this patient actually was diagnosed with his prostate cancer quite a while ago, I believe in 99. And originally was treated with radiation therapy alone with no ADT. He experienced a biochemical relapse some years after that in 2002. And it was managed by intermittent androgen deprivation therapy for sometimes actually about 10 years from 2002 to 2012. And then out of a sudden, this is plus or minus the time he came to me as I recall it. And actually at this time, his PSA was not falling nicely while on androgen deprivation therapy. So he was actually maintained on androgen deprivation therapy. PSA was, say, stable for some time until 2014, and then it started rising. And the rise was continuous. He was asymptomatic. His age was plus or minus 74 at this time, a quite fit man. And of course, he was anxious because his PSA was rising while on ADT. We did a bone scan and we did a CT scan, and we could not figure out, based on that, where the disease was located. So actually, this is exactly the definition of what we call non-metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. And I'm saying castration-resistant because, of course, we double-check his testosterone level, and that was confirmed as being at castrated levels. So again, PSA is rising, normal checkup by CT scan and bone scan, testosterone is castrated. At this time, actually, there was no real option to propose to this man. There was no standard of care. The guidelines said, just carry on with ADT and do a checkup once every whatever. And when you will be able to detect metastasis, then you will start something. Which, of course, was very non-comfortable for patients. You can imagine how anxious they can be when they see their PSA rising and rising and rising, and you just tell them, well, I have nothing to propose to you, but just to see you again in X month and do a CT scan.
At that time, what was the doubling time and how high was the PSA?
So he had a PSA of about 10 or 15, if I recall well, and his doubling time was clearly less than 10 months, which, as you know, is a prognostic factor predicting adversely for bad news to come soon, mainly bone metastasis or at least lymph node metastasis. I think his doubling time was even probably shorter, probably 5 or 6 months, if I recall well.
Before you go on, and we'll talk about sort of making the decision today as opposed to at that point, when you think about prognosis in a patient who is having progression, M0 progression, when you see longer doubling times, longer than 10 months, so 15 or 20 months, what's the prognosis there? It's not really the same as it is for the first relapse.
You're very right. Actually, this patient, especially because we're talking about a quite elderly population, when they have a doubling time, as you said, at 15 or 16 months, that's actually quite good, if you will. The time to death is at the moment unknown because the median was not reached for this population of men, but it's probably somewhere around 8 to 10 years, which is not that far from what it is for this population of men, of course. So you're right. I mean, this is quite reassuring when you see a PSA with a quite slow pace. You can really tell your patient, well, most of the disease is under control. We can just continue using surveillance on you, and it will be always time to act if needed. But obviously, it's not the same in a man with a more rapidly rising PSA.
So let's fast forward to the present time. We'll come back to your patient who actually went on a clinical trial. We'll hear about that in a second. But let's fast forward really just 3 years, actually, 3-4 years. And talk about right now what data we have to help guide us in this exact clinical situation.
Well, I guess we have very important piece of data that came out in the last 1 or 2 years from clinical trials, and I will say also a word about next-generation imaging. But first, regarding treatment, three large phase 3 randomized trials have focused on men with non-metastatic castration-resistant disease and a rapidly rising PSA, PSA doubling time less than 10 months. Actually, these three trials are very similar. They were all randomly assessing a next-generation androgen receptor antagonist versus a placebo, and of course, all men were kept on androgen deprivation therapy. These three drugs were enzalutamide, darolutamide, and apalutamide, and in all three phase 3 trials, the primary endpoint was metastasis-free survival, so basically the time it takes for a patient to develop a metastasis or to die from his disease or from something else. And of course, we had a bunch of secondary endpoint, the most important being overall survival, obviously. So all three trials read out in the last, well, let's say 2 years now, at the ASCO GU meeting, first back in 2018. And they all point to the same direction, which is a very strong and big benefit for all these three drugs in terms of metastasis-free survival. Actually, if you're using them instead of a placebo, you're reducing the risk of developing metastasis or death by about 60 to 70%, which is probably unprecedented. It's really, really big. The Kaplan-Meier curves are, you know, completely separated, things we would love to see as oncologists more often in other cancers. So that was, of course, a very, very important step forward. And it came together with clinical benefit, at least in two of these three randomized trials. For the third one, we don't know yet. But in the Spartan trial, which was testing apalutamide, time to symptoms was actually postponed with apalutamide. It was not only an image on a bone scan or a CT scan. And with darolutamide, time to pain progression was also prolonged with darolutamide. So we're very clearly doing some good to patients. It's not only, you know, postponing the time for a bone scan to be switched from white to black. It's really taking care of patients. Regarding overall survival, at the moment, the jury is out. Because when the primary analysis was performed, most of these men were actually alive, and this was true in both arms. Still, there was some indication that patients in the experimental arm might do better. For example, with the darolutamide trial in Aramis, the 3-year overall survival rate was 83% in the darolutamide arm versus 73% in the control arm, an absolute 10% difference. We need a bit more time to update this data with more events and see whether it's a true finding or not and whether the difference is truly significant. But obviously, it's a good sign.
Well, also, you know, this debate about progression-free survival versus overall survival goes throughout oncology, and a key issue is tolerability issues. And you are buying a lot of time in terms of metastasis-free survival. And to me, I mean, I know we'll talk about how you can separate out these three trials or these three agents, but more globally, even for all three of them, it looks like sort of a pretty good trade-off there in terms of the additional toxicity versus, at a minimum, a big jump in progression-free survival.
Correct. Actually, you're very right. These three drugs, generally speaking, in most patients are quite well tolerated. Still, we need to pay attention to some side effects. Apalutamide and enzalutamide penetrate the blood-brain barrier. Darolutamide doesn't. And probably it explains why we saw probably more side effects with apalutamide and enzalutamide as compared to placebo than what we saw for darolutamide, again, compared with placebo. Side effects such as intellectual fatigue is something we're seeing with the first two agents, but also sometimes some falls and fractures. Drug-drug interaction can be also some issues. For example, with enzalutamide, we see an excess in hypertension, and we don't really know what the mechanism for that is. It could actually well be that due to drug-drug interaction, antihypertension drugs do not do the effect we are expecting from them. So again, as a wrap-up, generally speaking, these three drugs are well tolerated. Still, darolutamide seems to be better tolerated. Again, it's not a direct comparison. It's always a comparison versus placebo, and it has its bias.
You know, it's been very interesting for me to try over these last few years to learn about fatigue with anti-androgen, at least what was initially called fatigue. And the more I talked to people, the more I got this more CNS flavor about what really is going on. So I wonder if you could maybe just, you know, kind of talk about how this all comes together in your own mind. I mean, when you meet with fellows or whatever, try to explain this phenomena, what do patients typically say to you? What do you see?
Actually, it's very variable. Some patients would have zero side effects, truly zero, that they can tell about from, say, enzalutamide or apalutamide. And obviously, this is very true with darolutamide. So no fatigue to report, no problem to concentrate, no nothing. And in most patients, of course, they would benefit regarding the anti-cancer activity. In some patients, you see either a difficulty for concentrating, memory impairments. Sometimes, you know, all patients might have a hard time finding their balance, again, because it's hard for them to concentrate on what they're doing. I remember some wife actually complaining and telling me, oh, doctor, he's really miserable. He's watching the TV all the time now. You know, so truly people losing autonomy and having a hard time concentrating on normal life, becoming much more passive. I remember another example is actually a younger guy who clearly benefited regarding his cancer. So he came back to me after a month or so, and he told me, you know what, I'm very happy. It was an enzalutamide, because obviously the drug you gave me works tremendously. My symptoms are out. And then he told me, he was an architect. He told me, but you know what, I'm turning stupid. I'm turning dumb. And he was, you know, smart enough to realize and to phrase it, if you will. And he could explain that in his job, he would have a hard time doing what he was doing normally.
Well, let me ask you something. Another phenomenon that you observe all the time is just men starting out on androgen deprivation. I mean, do they have these same kinds of symptoms?
It's not exactly the same thing. And it's much more progressive while on androgen deprivation therapy. Actually, patients starting on ADT would probably first complain about the hot flashes and probably the sexual impairment, sexual desire and potency. Those would be the main thing when starting androgen deprivation therapy. If there is some cognitive impairment, it will probably take years before it really happens and it has some consequences. While again, with AR antagonist, it's very rapid. Sometimes it's just a week or, you know, something like that. Sometimes it's reversible just by dose reducing. And very often I'm actually, you know, if I really have to start enzalutamide in a quite old gentleman, I'm starting half dose now just because of this. And then I'm trying to dose increase if I can. But if you've been starting with full doses and these patients are complaining from these side effects, then reducing, say, by half of the dose can sometimes fix the problem while keeping the efficacy. Of course, you never know whether the efficacy would be exactly what it would have been, but it seems to work, let's say.
I was going to ask you that. What about with anti-androgens in terms of, I don't know, the dose response curve? Like, theoretically, do you think it would compromise activity?
Yeah, it's not sure, actually. In all phase one trials, we saw efficacy at very low doses. And actually, the dose was picked up not because, at least in some cases, not based on toxicity, but more based on PKs. So again, to address your question, even low dose can work. Now, whether they work with the exact same effect as higher doses, of course, we don't know because we don't have randomized data. And you would need randomized data to make sure.
So I guess the question of the day, or the question I've had now, for, I don't know, it seems like a long time, but maybe it's only a year, is I was starting to get the feeling that a lot of people felt indirectly that darolutamide had a better toxicity profile, even though there wasn't head-to-head data, and I don't know if there ever will be. But what's your take on it? If you had the choice, maybe you do, of these three agents, would you prefer one versus the other?
Yes. Based on my experience, I think darolutamide is better tolerated. Again, with all the caveats that you mentioned, that we don't have direct comparison. But if I can say it another way, I've seen quite a number of men complaining from side effects from enzalutamide. I have much less experience with apalutamide. But with enzalutamide, all the symptoms I described to you, I saw that quite often. Now, with darolutamide, I've never seen that. And we did the two first phase one trials and then the two phase three trials, Aramis and also the Arasens trial in metastatic disease. I mean, generally speaking, it seems to be really a very well-tolerated agent. Now, again, we always need to be cautious regarding those things when we don't have direct comparisons.
It's really interesting. You know, there's so many situations right now in general medical oncology where there are multiple agents available. There's four PARP inhibitors, three CDK inhibitors, six checkpoint inhibitors. And most of the time, the investigators are not that, you know, clear about it. But this situation seems a little bit different, at least right now.
I agree. Actually, I also have experience with a PARP inhibitor, and I agree with you. In my experience, they're very similar in terms of efficacy and in terms of side effects as well. Maybe a little less or more that, but, you know, nothing strong. But for AR antagonist, it really seems that there is a difference between darolutamide and the two other agents.
Very interesting. So actually, it turns out your patient got darolutamide on the Aramis trial. What happened?
Well, he responded very nicely. His PSA fell down dramatically, and it was under control for, say, 18 months or so. And then it started rising again very, very slowly, but still with no detectable metastasis. So we actually decided to keep him on drug, and he was okay with that because, again, the pace of the PSA was not rapid, and he was also basically comfortable with his decision. Also because the CT scan and the bone scan remain normal. I saw him some weeks or months ago now, and he's still doing very, very well. He's probably 78 now, something like that. Still fit, still totally autonomous, enjoying life. And again, his imaging remained normal.
I see that he's on calcium, vitamin D, and a bisphosphonate. What are some of the long-term health preventive strategies you utilize in this situation?
I think this is a very important question. Many men are receiving androgen deprivation therapy for a long time, and I'm sure we need to pay more attention to the long-term side effects. And osteoporosis is one side effect of androgen deprivation, obviously. Unfortunately, I think only a minority of men are being managed a proper way regarding the bone loss. My practice is really not only to use vitamin D, calcium, and strongly recommend physical activity to these men, but also I'm doing a bone osteodensitometry, so mineral bone density measurements from time to time, so that we can actually switch these men to more potent agents, such as denosumab, for example. And I think this is important. You know, a recent example regarding that was provided at ASCO some 6 months ago, where the P3 trial was looked at. And actually, this is a randomized trial of enzalutamide plus or minus radium-223. And they actually look at the incidence of fractures, clinical fractures, in men, depending on whether they were on denosumab. And it's impressive, the difference that was shown in June. I think more and more we should pay more attention to bone loss and bone health in general in all the patients with prostate cancer receiving ADT.
That's interesting, because the next thing I was going to ask you is what you think is a likely path for this man over the next 5 years, assuming he remains in good health otherwise. And I guess one scenario I could imagine might be that at some point he might show up on imaging to have a bone met or bone mets but still be asymptomatic. And I'm curious if that were to happen in him, and he would be on darolutamide at the time, what would you do?
I mean, the honest answer is that we don't know what ideally we should do. The options I would probably discuss with him would be, number one, treat locally the single bone metastasis, because this is generally well tolerated when we're using radiation therapy. And with the caveat, of course, that we don't know whether we're truly doing some good to patients. And actually, randomized trials are currently underway to test that prospectively. But probably that would be my main recommendation. And I would probably keep chemotherapy for more aggressive progression with either symptoms or more lesions on the skeleton or elsewhere.
So let's assume there are more lesions, but again, the patient's not asymptomatic, but there are multiple lesions. I guess my question is, at what point, if any, would you be thinking about radium?
So that would be the scenario for radium. So again, exactly the one you're describing. A patient with multiple bone metastases in his elderly, actually he's currently 78 or so, so let's say it's going to be 80 plus, and say persymptomatic. So that would be a very good candidate for radium. The initial phase 3 for radium was tested actually in men failing chemotherapy or not fit enough to get chemotherapy. And you know, at this age, you need to be very cautious about chemotherapy depending on comorbidities. So that could be actually a very good reason to consider radium investment in the scenario you're describing.
You brought up before the issue of fractures. And there was an issue about radium as related to early death and then fractures. And I kind of got the feeling that that all sort of worked out. Is that the case? And is it still a consideration in patients with bone-only mets?
Actually, what was reported comes from the ERA 223 phase 3 trial. So that was a trial randomizing abiraterone plus or minus radium. And what happened was that not only the combo was not better than single agent abiraterone, but also it was worse in terms of fracture, and even there was a negative trend for survival. Which actually, when you think about it, nobody had thought about it up front, including me. But if you think about it, abiraterone might actually deplete strongly the bone in terms of calcium. So, because we know that ADT does it, and abiraterone might actually do an even worse job to the bone. And of course, if you're irradiating a bone which is already frail, you need a break. So it could well be the explanation. And actually, when the investigators came back to the scans to try to figure out whether those fractures were osteoporotic fractures or fracture on a bone mat, so pathological fractures, it was a mix of the two, but predominantly osteoporotic fractures, which means that actually we're not doing some good, again, to the bone with all the treatments, and we need to pay more attention to that. In the second trial, the PEACE-3 trial, which was testing also the same concept with radium, but this time it was added on top of enzalutamide, actually adding denosumab switched the incidence of fractures for about 20% or so on enzalutamide single agent and up to 40% with a combo enza plus radium, down to almost 0%. So I think clinically this is super important to remember and to tell to all our colleagues when using treatments for prostate cancers, systemic treatments, please think about bone health, manage your patient, do bone density measurements, consider using denosumab or zelenic acid. All those things are truly important.
So, you know, it's interesting. Your case really has made me think about something that probably you and your colleagues have been thinking about for a long time, but it sort of just hit me, which is sort of the, quote, old paradigm of upfront treatment of metastatic disease really is going to be completely changed and shifted because you're going to have all these people who've gotten anti-androgens before they ever have mets. So your patient, who I don't think is going to be that unusual, probably isn't right now, if he does develop metastatic disease, at first metastatic disease, will be on an antiandrogen. So the question is, what's next? And if it's a patient with bone-only disease, you have the option of radium. But if it's a patient who has significant disease outside, then the question is, what's next? And that kind of seems like it would tie in to your big paper at ESMO, looking at cabazitaxel in patients progressing on hormone therapy. But I was thinking about that more like for Mets, but maybe it's going to be more like this.
You're probably quite right, indeed. We will see more and more patients receiving strong AR targeting agents in the earlier situations. That's very true. Either metastatic de novo or non-metastatic, which means that when they progress, we need to invent a new clinical management for these men. So obviously, I think there are at least two quite strong messages for our colleagues regarding those situations. One is that, unfortunately, sequencing AR-targeted agent after the other doesn't really work. So I think this is very important to remember. It's easy doing, of course, because it's just, you know, a prescription and a piece of paper, and your next patient is almost in front of you. But it doesn't work. Of course, it's expensive on top of that. And your patient might well come back to you in 3 to 4 months from now with symptoms because you've not been able to treat his cancer. So this is the bad news, but we need really to be aware of that and probably to stop sequencing, say, abiraterone and enzalutamide, and very likely that's also true for apalutamide and darolutamide. We don't have data, but it's very likely. So the good news is that taxane remain active in men who have failed an AR targeting agent. And indeed, you're very right. I mean, the CARD phase 3 trial was focusing on men who had exhausted one AR targeted agent, and actually one taxane as well for most of them, and for all of them actually. And those men were randomized to receive either the second AR targeting agent, so let's say enzalutamide if you had received abiraterone up front, or the second taxane, cabazitaxel, after docetaxel. And actually, cabazitaxel was clearly the winner, with not only progression-free survival, radiographic progression-free survival, which was a primary endpoint, being met clearly and very significantly, but also the secondary endpoint of overall survival was improved by cabazitaxel when compared versus abiraterone or enzalutamide, which is very important. And when you think about it, we're both oncologists, so we've been treating different cancers. How many cases in our career have we seen situations in oncology where a fourth-line agent is still able to postpone death? And this is an example, because cabazitaxel, technically speaking, is a fourth-line treatment. You've at least exhausted androgen deprivation therapy, an AR-targeted agent, docetaxel, and then this is your fourth treatment, at the minimum, because sometimes some patients have already received some other agents. Which means that it remains very important to do these trials and to demonstrate clearly what's best for patients. And I think this is a very important message.
So you stated that, you know, secondary hormonal therapy doesn't work, but there are some patients where it works in. And I guess one thing that we've heard over the last few years, the question is whether you can identify them with any assays. There's the ARVN7 assay. Any thoughts about that?
You're right. When I'm saying that they don't work, it means they don't work for the majority. So let's say, you know, 60, 70, 80% of patients will not benefit at all. Okay, but it doesn't mean that they don't work in some patients, but again, that's a minority. Unfortunately, we don't have a biomarker ready for prime time at the moment, and the ARV7 story, for example, is very complex. This is clearly a prognostic factor, but whether it's predictive is really debatable, to be honest. So in other words, having a V7 variant is not a good news for a patient because it means that his cancer is very aggressive. Now, whether it will predict for efficacy or absence of efficacy of a given drug, that really remains to be demonstrated. And at least we cannot safely use it in our practice.
So again, thinking about patients who might get started on anti-androgen like darolutamide, like your patient, and then have metastatic disease. Where is CYP-T fitting in nowadays? Same place as always?
Right. Actually, it's even more difficult for me to address your question because, as you probably know, CYP-T is currently used only in the US. It was actually approved in Europe some years ago, but it was never commercialized because it was felt that this was too complex and too expensive for the benefit provided in the phase 3 trial. But at least what my colleagues from the US are telling me is that in some patients with quite indolent disease, they still recommend it, but not in all patients, obviously. So unfortunately, we haven't had any phase 3 comparison with CYP-T in the last 10 years. So it's really difficult for me to tell you where it might fit in the current environment, because all these drugs we've been speaking about today didn't exist when the first phase 3 trial of CYP-T was actually conducted, again, more than 10 years ago now.
Let's talk a little bit about the management of hormone-sensitive disease, and maybe we can talk about patients presenting with metastatic disease. And before we talk about that, I'm curious whether you think it's becoming more common to see men presenting with mets. Do you think there's less screening going on?
So I think for sure we're paying more attention to these men, thanks to the trials we've seen in the last 5 years. And some people actually realize that these men exist. In the past, many of these men were actually managed by urologists. And a urologist would make the diagnosis because they do the biopsy, they would do the imaging checkup, bad news, there are metastasis. They would start the patient on ADT, say for 1 year or so, the patient would do good, and nobody was paying attention to these men until they would develop castration-resistant disease. But in the last years, because we've seen very good news from phase 3 trials with first docetaxel, but probably even more importantly with next-generation AR-targeted agents, abiraterone, and so on, people are really paying attention to that. There is a debate, I know, in the U.S. as to whether these patients are being seen truly more frequently because the screening has declined. The numbers of the percentages remain quite small, so it's difficult to know whether it's a true finding or not, because I know also that some pro-screening are using this reason to say, well, we were right, basically. I think we need to be cautious and see with longer follow-up whether this is a true finding or not in the US. But actually, I can provide you some other example from other countries. When I'm traveling to Eastern Asia, for example, my colleagues there are telling me that about 60 to 70% of a newly diagnosed men with prostate cancer have metastasis, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, 60 to 70% of men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer have metastasis, in, say, in China, in India, and in many other countries.
Is there screening going on there?
No, there's no screening.
No screening. But I mean, you know, even in the U.S., though, I don't know that it was ever that high even before there was much screening. That seems really high. Or was that the way it was?
It was higher indeed in the U.S. and in Europe. But I think it was more, say, 30%, let's say, back in the 70s, you know, a long time ago, 50 years ago or so. But it came down to 5%, you know, something in this range in Western countries. Now, again, whether it's truly rising now, we need to look at the data. There might be a trend. We need to make sure it's true or not. But anyway, whatever the situation, it's true that we still see those men, and it's true also that they die from their cancer. We did a survey, for example, in my center some years ago, and we looked at basically who dies from prostate cancer. And what we found was that half of men who die from the disease are men with de novo metastatic prostate cancer, while the other half would be a man who was originally diagnosed with localized disease and things didn't turn well, meaning that de novo metastatic disease is a big problem in terms of risk of dying, which is obvious, but still, it remains to be remembered.
Can you talk about how you approach the man who presents with metastatic disease and what the key trials are that are shaping your decisions and how your approach changes when the patient gets older, the patient has more disease versus less disease?
I think, well, Basically, one thing we need to pay attention is the presentation of the disease. For example, how many metastases the patient has, whether it's lymph node disease only, bone disease, visceral disease, because the prognosis is truly different and actually the clinical management might change. So, for example, for men with oligometastatic disease, we now have level 1 evidence that a local treatment with radiation therapy on top of a systemic treatment makes a difference, and this is true for both progression-free survival, but also, and of course, most importantly, for overall survival. And that was demonstrated about a year ago in the STAMPEDE phase 3 trial. So in other words, we're now integrating local radiation therapy in men with oligometastatic disease, say a man with lymph node disease only, or a gentleman with less than 3 bone metastases and no visceral disease.
Can I just clarify, are you talking about radiating the primary or treating the primary, not the mets, right?
We are actually using radiation therapy directed to the primary because we have level 1 evidence that we should do it in these men, but not towards the metastases. And for this question, phase 3 trials are currently underway.
Really? You mean treating oligometastatic disease versus not randomized trials?
Correct.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
What are the sites that usually nodes? Where do you see oligomets with prostate usually?
Well, usually it's either lymph nodes or bone metastases. So bone metastases, the definition, of course, is debatable and nobody knows exactly how many mets do you need to have to be qualified or considered as an oligometastatic man. But let's say that it's somewhere between 1 to 5, you know, something reasonable. And actually some people think that it's more 3 or something. But it could be also lymph node disease, and with more recent imaging, PSMA PET, PET-Coline, whole body MRI, we see more and more of these men with, say, 1, 2, 3 lymph nodes here and there in the pelvis or in the retroperitoneum. So whether we should treat locally with radiation or maybe with surgery, actually, these mets, we don't know. And again, trials are randomly testing this hypothesis.
Really interesting. So let's think about a more typical patient. Maybe they've got several bone mets. Maybe there's one you're going to radiate, but there's still some others. Patients in their late 70s, maybe a little bit of comorbidities. What are the options you think about, and what are the key trials that you're thinking about?
For 70 years, we've been treating these men the same, which was castration alone, androgen deprivation alone. Started back in the 40s until basically 2015, plus or minus. And out of a sudden, we had trials establishing that the Taxol chemotherapy can actually change the game, with overall survival being demonstrated on top of androgen deprivation, obviously. Having said that, more recently, when these trials were updated, they were much less optimistic. You know, initially when they were analyzed, it was suggested that a 40% reduction in the risk of death could be obtained with the Taxol chemotherapy. But actually, with more trials and longer follow-up, it's actually less than 20% improvement in survival. Of course, it's better than nothing, but still, patients are dying. Now, probably even more important were the findings from trials that released in the last 2 years or so. And I'm talking about trials looking at abiraterone and trials looking at enzalutamide and apalutamide. In all these trials, and actually I haven't counted, but I'm talking about probably 5 trials, you know, so 5 big phase 3 trials with more than 1,000 men in each of them, about a 35% reduction in the risk of death was demonstrated. So very robust data, and it's really impressive. Trial after trial, almost exactly the same curves, exactly the same hazard ratio, et cetera. So I think we can trust this data. And in the first trial that was conducted, which was Latitude with abiraterone, we now have long-term follow-up for these men, and actually the benefit remained almost exactly the same with more time, and of course more men in the control arm receiving active agents. which truly suggest that with these drugs, earlier treatments is better than deferred treatment when the disease has already adapted and is castration resistant. So I think this is, we're really moving from chemotherapy to AR targeting with next generation AR axis targeting with these various agents now. Of course, you may argue about one versus the other one. The main advantage of chemotherapy being to be cheap. And of course, that's important to remember. But in terms of efficacy and side effect, it really seems that next generation hormonal therapy do a better job.
What specific agents, though, have been looked at?
So abiraterone, enzalutamide, apalutamide, and docetaxel are the four agents that were randomly tested for whom we had some data in the last years.
So assuming you could access it from a clinical point of view, do you think that these are all interchangeable plus? For example, you didn't mention abiraterone or you talked about M0 disease because there's no data, but do you think it'd be okay to use it?
Well, for M0 disease, we don't know. I think we still need to be cautious because there's also the issue of long-term side effects. Coming back to the examples we've discussed together, an M0 man, you need to think not only about the man we're facing, but the man who you might be facing in 3-5 years' time. And this is where long-term toxicity makes a difference. So I think we should stick to the evidence that we have, because sometimes in oncology, as you know, we see bad surprises in the long term with side effects. So I would probably not use abiraterone if I could use enzalutamide, darolutamide, or apalutamide in an M0 CRPC situation, again, because we don't have data in the space. I think it's safer to stick to evidence. And, you know, in my country, actually, I would not be allowed to do that because you have approval and reimbursement processes. Now, for the M1 situation, I think you might argue between abiraterone and enzalutamide if these two drugs are approved in your country because the data are quite robust in both cases. And this is actually quite true for apalutamide as well. The data are quite recent. They came out. But again, there seems to be quite similar one versus the other one. Of course, with a caveat of toxicity, and you need to choose wisely depending on the patients you're facing.
I'm not sure. I don't think I've seen M1 data with darolutamide.
You're correct. We're waiting for the phase 3. It will take time because darolutamide came after the three others, actually. And the trial could conclude its accrual maybe a year ago, something like that. So we need to follow this man. And because overall survival is a key endpoint in all these trials, you need data to mature enough before we see them.
So you wouldn't say, well, we know or we think it's better tolerated. Maybe we ought to use it in M1, even though we don't have the data yet?
No, I think we should not. I think it's important to have evidence before we make a decision, especially when you have alternatives that are viable. You know, abiraterone, for example, is usually quite well tolerated and the data are quite strong. We have abiraterone in the setting. So, you know, in my daily practice, I feel quite comfortable using abiraterone to these men with M1 disease.
Although, you know, I've heard, which kind of has surprised me, but on the other hand, maybe not, that some patients would rather get chemo because they want to get it over with.
It might be also related to financial reasons, to be honest.
Right.
Of course, when you're paying out of pocket, you know, the docetaxel is a cheap agent. It's been generic for a decade or so, so it costs nothing. So basically, you're done in 4.5 months. And depending, of course, on how much the hospital will charge you, depending on your country, but it might be quite a cheap option. Now, if you're using abiraterone or enzalutamide or apalutamide, again, depending on your country, the cost might change, but it's probably several thousand euros or dollars every month. Again, if you're paying out of pocket, it makes a difference. That's very obvious.
So, you know, a lot of times we have to just live with the data that we have. But one thing I have been kind of wondering about are taxanes and prostate cancer. Obviously, docetaxel was kind of the original taxane. What do we know, though, for example, I don't know if you have any sort of data or even clinical experience to compare cabazitaxel to docetaxel? Is it just a question of that's the way the trials were done? Would there be any rationale to use cabazitaxel first? How much do we know about paclitaxel, nab-paclitaxel in prostate?
You're right, actually. I mean, paclitaxel, for example, was never really developed in prostate cancer. There was a couple of phase two a long time ago, almost 20 years now, but the decision was never made to move to phase three development, probably because of a loss of patent, to be honest. Now, for cabazitaxel, cabazitaxel was first shown to be active post-docetaxel, that's right, but we had actually a big phase three trial comparing the two taxanes in the first-line setting. And this trial was testing docetaxel, cabazitaxel with a dose of 20 milligrams per square meter, and cabazitaxel with a dose of 25 milligrams per square meter, so two doses of CABA. And actually, if you're really looking, let's say as a doctor, as you and me would do, to the data, probably cabazitaxel 20 was the winner, because the efficacy was really the same across arms. The Kaplan-Meier curves are really, really similar, if not exactly the same. And regarding the toxicity, the side effect, cabazitaxel 20 was less toxic than cabazitaxel 25, but also less toxic than docetaxel was. So ideally, you know, in my practice, I would prefer using cabazitaxel 20 as, you know, the first taxane to use. Now, in terms of approval, that's not the case because this was a superiority trial and CABA was not superior to Doci, so it's not approved in this indication, so I cannot use it. But you're very right. I mean, if I really had the choice to do so, I would use CABA 20. We actually did, you know, at my center, a randomized phase two trial, a patient's preference trial. So we were giving either docetaxel or cabazitaxel first, and then a 3 month time, so four cycles, we're switching for patients, of course, not progressing for ethical reasons, we're switching to the other taxane for an additional four cycles or so. And then at the end, we were asking the patient which one he preferred. And there was actually a preference for cabazitaxel.
That's really amazing. What was it specifically? Which side effect could they tell the difference on?
So the main side effects are actually fatigue, hair loss, which is much more frequent with docetaxel as compared to cabazitaxel, and also quality of life in general. On top of that, we all know that docetaxel has more neurotoxicity, has more nail problems, while cabazitaxel has more hematotoxicity, but this is something you can prevent with G-CSF support, and more rarely some diarrhea.
I was kind of flashing on some of the debates that went on about pazopanib and sunitinib and renal cell cancer, but that all got blown away with checkpoint inhibitors and everything else. But I remember at one point that was kind of similar to what you were talking about. Let's finish out talking about PARP inhibitors and prostate cancer. And I want to ask you about the 77-year-old man, but first, just getting back to your other patient, the man who's on the Aramis trial. We talked about the possibility that he might, you know, in his 80s, develop metastatic disease. Just kind of curious, putting aside reimbursement issues, ideally, assuming he has no family history, what, if anything, do you think should be done at first diagnosis of metastatic disease in a situation like that in terms of working a patient up for potential PARP inhibitor?
I think we now have stronger data enough to support germline testing and somatic when we can. But germline is becoming doubly important. Number one, for the man himself, because if he's BRCA2, let's say, mutated, this means that we're going to probably treat him a different way, knowing what we know now with PARP inhibitors and maybe carboplatin, but also for his family. If ever we can avoid one death by ovarian cancer or breast cancer, of course, we've done all the job as doctors. And this is my practice, to be honest. All patients now who are developing metastatic disease, and specifically those with de novo metastatic disease, I recommend them germline testing. It's also because it's quite easy for me in my country. It's quite cheap and quite easy doing. The system will cover that. And actually, the incidence that we see of BRCA2 mutated men is quite high in this population of men.
So germline BRCA or germline panel?
Well, we do panel, you're right, because you know, the cost is very similar and it's the same for the patient. But it's mostly BRCA that pops up as being mutated.
So you have this 77-year-old man who was first seen in 2018, was known BRCA2 mutation carrier. The sister and daughter had breast cancer. Before we go on, what do you do in terms of screening for prostate cancer in men with known germline mutations like this man?
That's a very good question. And the honest answer is that we don't know. And this is exactly something we want to assess prospectively in studies. And I think we should pay attention to that. I would probably do or recommend a PSA screening, but whether we should also do, for example, an MRI of a prostate from time to time, we just don't know. We have no clue. But this is maybe something we should consider doing, and we have ideas about looking at that prospectively.
So I see that this man has metastatic disease. He was actually, looks like he was initially diagnosed in 2010, Mets, castrate-resistant 2015, goes on abiraterone, and then I guess he had disease progression and came up for the possibility of a trial. So what happened?
You know what? This is very typical of these men with BRCA mutations. Either they are diagnosed with bad local cancers, and this one, for example, had a Gleason 9 prostate cancer, or they are diagnosed with de novo metastatic disease. By itself, having a BRCA2 germline mutation is a bad prognostic factor. So you're right, these patients received abiraterone for 2 years. And again, this is also a message for colleagues. It's not because the patient is BRCA2 mutated or have a DDR mutation that the normal treatments, let's call them this way, for prostate cancer will not work. Abiraterone, taxane, etc. The difference with classical or other patients is that they might work a shorter amount of time. So I think this is an important message to all our colleagues. So basically, yes, he was progressing by PSA, but still in a good shape, performance status 0, asymptomatic, and he was developing new bone lesions on the bone scan. So we proposed him to participate to a trial comparing a PARP inhibitor versus a second hormonal agents. And because actually at this time, you know, what I told you about the cross-resistance between AR-targeted agents was much less known as compared to right now. So he agreed on participating, and he was randomized in the enzalutamide arm, so in the control arm first. And that was more than a year ago, almost 2 years now. And actually, things didn't turn well for this man while on enzalutamide. His PSA kept rising. His general status started deteriorating in 3 or 4 months' time. And actually even broke his femur. So we had to operate on him. So
he had a pathologic fracture?
Correct.
Was he having pain prior to that time?
Well, he had modest pain, but he fell down on his femur and he broke it.
It's interesting, though, too, that he had some cognitive impairment, enzalutamide, going back to our discussion about CNS effects. This man falls. Do you think this was like a CNS fall?
It's always hard to say because I was not with him exactly at this time. But it's true that he had some CNS troubles when I met him, and the wife was telling me, you know, all these things. There was something there. So again, you would see these side effects on enzalutamide.
Hmm.
The good thing in this trial was that at the time of progression, by imaging, you had the possibility to cross over your patient to experimental drug, which was a PARP inhibitor, which actually turned out to be active in this man. And it was really fantastic response. Again, he could start walking, of course, thanks also to the surgery. The cognitive impairment went away. But also, and most importantly, the other bone pain that he was starting having at different spots from his bony lesions completely disappeared, and we could stop opioids and more generally painkillers. So we actually switched him to the PARP inhibitor about a year ago, and I just saw him. He's doing super well. Last summer, he went to Envy Alps for walking with his wife. You know, very nice story that we love to see when the cancer is under control. And actually, his PSA is still declining, and his bone scan is also improving, and this was almost a year now.
So I see that he did have a little bit of anemia. His hemoglobin was 10.5, platelets 105,000, but he hasn't needed a transfusion. Let's bring up the issue of toxicity of PARP inhibitors in men with prostate cancer. It seems like the side effects are pretty consistent with what's been seen with other cancers. In the phase 3 PROFOUND study, olaparib was generally well tolerated, and the majority of adverse events were mild and included anemia, nausea, fatigue, and asthenia. Grade 3 or higher anemia occurred in about 20% of olaparib-treated patients, and about 16% required discontinuation because of adverse events. The safety profile of rucaparib in the TRITON2 study was also similar to that reported with studies in ovarian cancer and other solid tumors. Overall, the most common adverse events included nausea, asthenia, fatigue, and anemia, and about 10% of patients had to discontinue treatment due to an adverse event. In the Galahad study with niraparib, grade 3-4 adverse events were primarily hematologic, including anemia in about 30% of patients and thrombocytopenia in 15%. About 20% of patients stopped treatment due to an adverse event. It seems like all the PARP inhibitors cause some degree of myelosuppression. Is that your take?
Absolutely. It might be, let's say, a bit different from one to the other. You're right, I have the same feeling as you that niraparib might actually have a stronger effect on platelets than others, but the anemia can be seen with perhaps more with others. So again, mild difference, like probably you and me were dealing with chemotherapies and you would see more or less of that. The good news from my experience is more about the GI side effects, because I was thinking, you know, before having my own experience, what benefit do we need to see to justify making someone sick from GI tract side effects for months, you know, continuously? And actually, that was really a good experience that I had. Most of my patients do not complain from GI tract side effects, or they're telling me it's generally mild. The anemia is there, and with some other PARP inhibitors, you have actually to dose reduce, or you have to give patients breaks and transfusions. But I think I've never had to stop a PARP inhibitor because of a GI tract toxicity.
Yeah, it's interesting when you ask, there's some people, some of the GYN people use preemptive anti-GI medicines. Other people say it's not much of a problem. I guess the one thing about prostate cancer, I don't know if it has anything to do with anything, but they are on androgen deprivation at the same time. So I don't know whether, I don't know, maybe there's some kind of interaction, who knows? But it's interesting that I see this patient didn't have any GI effects. He sounds like he's having a great response. I kind of get the feeling that with rare exceptions, these responses don't last forever.
It's probably hard to say because, you know, the current follow-up is not fantastically long in the trials that we have. But I think you're right. I mean, this is very aggressive disease again. And the cancer is able to find ways, unfortunately. And it's true that in most of my patients, after 6 or 8 months, I see a patient experiencing progression, sometimes a little longer, 10 months, a year, etc. This one, for example, has probably 11 months or something now, and really is benefiting clinically and biologically like magic. And it's not unique. I took this one because I saw him 2 weeks ago, but I've seen really a number of men truly dramatically benefiting clinically. Again, we're happy when we see PSA drops, but most importantly, humanly speaking, is when your patient is clinically benefiting. Many of these men are on pain. Again, this is not a good cancer to have. They're very symptomatic locally and at the level of a metastasis. And in some men, it's magic. You really see the symptoms improving and a man coming back to you and basically saying thank you.
So many questions come up about PARP inhibitors, not just in prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, and of course, breast and ovarian cancer. But one of the things that you always hear about, particularly in BRCA mutation carriers, is the issue that you mentioned before, platinums. So, you know, platinums are a big issue in ovary. They're sort of a big issue in breast and in pancreas, but I don't know exactly where platinums fit in terms of prostate.
Right. So we know for quite a long time now that about, say, 20% of men will respond on platinums when they have prostate cancer, and including patients at very advanced stages when you have really exhausted all what you have. So this is quite well known. So I guess experts have been, you know, in the last 2 decades, have been using platinums, at least in some patients, in their practice, based on this evidence. We also have a randomized trial, which was testing sertraplatin, which was an oral agent. Actually, radiographic progression-free survival was clearly improved, but not overall survival, for whatever reasons. So there is something ongoing, and it could actually well be that patients with BRCA-mutated cancers are the one who benefit. We need more data, and hopefully we will have prospective data, which we don't have at the moment, but it could well be the case. If so, you're right, the question will raise, should we use a platin or should we use a PARP inhibitor? I mean, with one, of course, you'll have a cheaper price. With the other one, you'll have an oral agent, you know, so it can go back and forth. And most importantly is the question of whether we will be able to circumvent resistance to the first agent, whatever that is, platin or PARP inhibitor, with a second one. At the moment, we don't know.
You know what happens when we say to a general medical oncologist, you have a patient with a BRCA germline mutation who has metastatic breast cancer, how would you treat them? You know that one of the most common answers they give is platinum followed by PARP maintenance, except there's no data in breast. They're taking that from ovary because it makes sense to them. And, you know, really it is a compelling thought, but in prostate, you have no data, correct?
That's right. We are actually discussing about testing it and doing it. But you're right. Right now, we have no data.
So the final question about PARP, you know, when you hear cases like this of patients who do so well and their life changes, you certainly don't want to miss someone who might have that opportunity. So BRCA germline kind of seems easy, but then the question is, what else? What other germline mutations right now would you want to treat if you could? And what somatic mutations, BRCA, HRD, what would you like to be able to treat?
It's really early data that we have, to be honest. Let me, for example, take the PROfound phase 3 trial that came out, because this is the biggest piece of data that we have at the moment. And this was testing olaparib randomly. And again, PFS was clearly improved, and even overall survival seems to go the very right way. It's right now considered as non-significant, even if the p-value is less than 0.05, because this was an interim analysis, but clearly things go the right way. So what we've learned from this trial is not only that olaparib seems to be better than a second AR antagonist, but also that genes are not the same, including DNA repair genes. So I think we can say safely that BRCA2 predicts for efficacy. And I'm saying safely because the number of men is strong enough to say, and the magnitude of the difference is there. So probably no discussion about that. Now, ATM, which is also very frequent in terms of abnormalities, is much more debatable. The difference between control is really small. So whether we should actually treat men with a PARP inhibitor when they have ATM aberrations is something that you might argue about. BRCA1, the number of men is small, so hard to say. CDK12 loss is the one that comes after that. Actually, it's fun, it's strange, because phase 2 trial suggested that the efficacy might not be the one you would like to see for CDK12 loss, but actually the randomized trial suggests that there is a benefit, or at least there is a trend, because again, the numbers are small, favoring olaparib as compared to a control arm. So I think we will need more data to clearly identify who are the men who should benefit from a PARP inhibitor. And this is also true for other genes, CHEK2, et cetera, et cetera.
CDK12, what is that?
CDK12 is a gene that also involves in DNA repair, but it's not exactly, you know, a little higher than BRCA1 or BRCA2R, if you will.
Interesting.
And actually, CDK12 loss might predict for immunotherapy activity in this disease. Primitive data, but it seems to be the case.
I just had this flashback. We're doing a satellite at the ASCO GU meeting not that long ago, maybe 3-4 years ago. You might have been on the panel, I don't remember. But in any event, I asked one investigator, we had six investigators, and I asked this investigator, I said, do you ever test for BRCA? And have you ever given a prostate cancer patient PARP inhibitor? And the doc says, yeah, I test for it, and I've seen a response. And then I asked the next person, same answer. All six said the same thing. And I'm like, I think something's about to happen.
Here you go.
Well, it did, right?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And well, we also have to recognize that PARP inhibitors do not work in all patients who are mutated. And I think this is also important to communicate to all our colleagues, because I've seen some frustration amongst the investigators telling me, hey, I've been testing, you know, 100 men to pick up a few, and actually it doesn't work in the 2 or 3 patients I've been treating due to bad luck. And it's actually true. We don't understand all the biology. We need to be humble, obviously. But it's also fair to say that at least in half of these men, say with BRCA2 mutation, you will see activity where you would probably not see it with some other agents, because again, that's bad cancers.
Actually, we just did a survey of 77 general medical oncologists, so they, you know, take care of everything. And one of the things we said is, have you ever given a PARP inhibitor to a man with prostate cancer? And more than half of them had, outside of trial. And then we said, did you have a patient who responded? And 3/4 said yes. They had people with NTRK that they were treating. So they're out there looking for stuff.
I think this is very important feedback.
Subsequent to the recording of this program, on December 16, 2019, the FDA approved enzalutamide for patients with metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Prostate Cancer Update.